Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod. I'm Anna-Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician. I'm the Human Futures Fellow at the College of Health and Medicine here at the Australian National University. I'm solo again this week with my intrepid colleague, the fabulous Professor Sharon Bessel, working in Scandinavia. In her absence, and for those of us who are missing her, I can highly recommend two remarkable recent pieces from Sharon that have been published in The Conversation, reflecting on thoughts and ideas of Australian children and what they would like to see from our society. It's a great read. Listeners will be aware that on Policy Forum Pod, we've shifted our focus in recent time towards systems under strain, exploring important policy areas where there are complex problems that in many cases have been neglected for many years and where there's an urgent need for change and solutions. We've talked about climate change, protecting biodiversity, water and energy security, and over the past three episodes, we've been looking at the Australian healthcare system. I've been working in the system for decades, and I still do with most of my time, yet the depth of the distress and dysfunction was challenging for me. And the need for transformative change is even more important now than ever before. There's so much to do. Of course, Policy Forum Pod aims to foster great discussion and debate about the complex challenges of our time. We're based at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. The Crawford School is a global leader in training thinkers and leaders who will help address the issues that we discuss regularly on this pod. Visit crawford.anu.edu.au/study if you want to find out more about the amazing range of degree programs and short courses that are on offer. So to this week, from patient distress, ambulance ramping and access block for serious health conditions to the mental health and well-being of my friends and colleagues, I really did find the series on health system discussions quite confronting. It's been a grim reminder of the need to foster hope and to value care. So this week, I thought we might pause for a brief interruption, a time perhaps to recenter ourselves toward hope and the broad mechanisms for social change, to ask how our society is caring for itself and for those around us and for the planet on which we rely. So I've asked a global leader in wellbeing economics and a person with a beautiful model for living democracy, two key elements to transformative change, to join me today in conversation, a conversation about our future. And so I have these two wonderful guests with me today, and I'd love to start by asking them to introduce themselves to the audience. Catherine, can we start with you?
Sure. Hello. My name is Catherine Trebek, and I guess I'm an advocate for economic system change, and that's manifested in all sorts of ways. In the last few years, I've been one of the co-founders of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, which would be great to talk about, sort of global collaboration of folks working together to change the economic system. And I've just returned from 17 years living in Glasgow in Scotland, back to my hometown of Canberra, and now I'm doing all sorts of little roles here, including a small role with the Centre for Policy Development. I've just joined the University of Edinburgh back in Scotland as a writer in residence and a couple of other roles, but they're the big ones.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have you back in Canberra, Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us. And beside Catherine is Tim Hollow. Tim, would you mind introducing yourself to an audience who may, some of whom at least may know you?
Thanks, Anna Greta. It's lovely to be here with you and Catherine today. So I'm the Executive Director of the Green Institute, which is the Australian Greens think tank. I've also been involved in various ways in environmental advocacy and campaigning and community activism in all sorts of ways over many, many years. I set up the Canberra's Buy Nothing groups and been involved in kind of little libraries and things like that, as well as being a campaigner with Greenpeace and an advisor to Christine Milne at Parliament and a musician. And I've just got my first book out, as you mentioned, Living Democracy, an ecological manifesto for the end of the world as we know it.
Fantastic. So that may actually be the place to start. Tim, I'm going to use that opening line from your book, Living Democracy, to help us set the scene for the discussion today. Here, at the end of the world as we know it, two very different realities stretch out in front of us. End of the world as we know it. Can you tell us why you think this is the case? What are the challenges that we're facing right now?
Well, I think they're many and varied and reasonably obvious in some ways. You know, most obviously, I think for many of us, we have the climate and ecological crisis kind of bearing down on us in a way which for many feels like the end of the world. And this is kind of one of the key drivers for me in writing this book. My 16-year-old is a very active school striker, and I speak to a whole lot of young people quite a lot who are not just deeply distressed about the state of the world, but very often, you know, extremely depressed and genuinely kind of feeling like this is the end of the world, like there is no real future for them. And that extends in all sorts of ways to some of the slightly older crowd who might have gone through uni and kind of find themselves at the end of even a master's degree with no serious job opportunities and no possibility to find themselves to be able to break into the housing market unless they've got parents who can afford to buy them property. It's, you know, the challenges and threats to our democratic systems that are growing all over the world, with the rise of authoritarianism, neo-fascism in all sorts of, you know, threatening and deeply challenging ways. And in those challenges, in those crises, there is an extraordinary moment, a possibility for change, because at the same time as people are searching for meaning, searching for possibility, people are starting to build a different way of being. There are people all over the world building different models of economic interaction and participation, different models of democratic participation and different models of governance, new models of geopolitical organizing growing, all sorts of extraordinary things. And so, yeah, in this moment where it feels like it could be the end of the world is an opportunity for it to be the end of the world as we know it. And a really dramatic transformational shift over the years ahead.
Catherine, what do you think about Tim's framing, the end of the world as we know it, a singular moment in time? Are there other challenges that you'd like to mention?
I mean, I think the way Tim's framed it is very powerful, because I think the reality is the world is going to face massive, monumental change that will disrupt people's lives and what they're used to. The question to me that I'm holding is, to what extent will that almost be won by disaster and uncontrolled and not on the terms and not in a way that communities would like, and people will feel that it's all, that they have no agency, that it's out of control, and all the stress and anxiety that come with that. And it will be even more unequal and painful for certain groups and the less powerful. Or the choice that I think humanity is facing right now is that they can recognize that business as usual is just not good enough, that the recipes that governments have offered over the last few decades are no longer fit for purpose, and we can argue whether they were even ever fit for purpose. And the question is, whether do we keep reaching for those recipes and just pressing go on the same old playbook, or do we recognize that we are in completely new terrain here? I mean, there was research out this week from scientists who are looking at more and more tipping points being breached. We're seeing scientists warn of, you know, six mass extinction loss. But I think one of the words Tim used is people feeling just deeply depressed. And that sense of despair in the future, I think, is one of the scariest dynamics under sort of really cutting all these multiple crises that humanity is facing, because what that means is then people feel there's no point taking action. And so they either run for the hills, and if they're wealthy enough, you know, they might be able to build their nice eco farms in New Zealand, or if they're even wealthier than that, shoot themselves off into space as some of the, you know, the tech billionaires are attempting. Or they're on, you know, the front lines of this crisis that is bearing down on communities, and we've seen that for decades. And so I think the question is not whether the same old story is going to just play out in a few more chapters. It's whether humanity collectively decides to really recognize the extent of change that's needed and work together in a collaborative, positive way to put the sort of the footsteps on that transition journey and making sure that no one is left behind. That sort of beautiful phrase from the Sustainable Development Goals, say what you might about the SDGs themselves, but that beautiful phrase of no one left behind, that has to, I think, be the project that we have to, you know, set ourselves for the next year, the next decade, next century.
Starting tomorrow. This is, of course, the reason why I've invited you to join the podcast for this week, is to inject an overall sense of hope and to give us some roadmaps that might be useful across the wide range of policy challenges that we're currently facing. So, Catherine, let's start with economics. It seems to come up as a theme when we talk about any of the major policy challenges. If we talk about climate change or biodiversity preservation, social issues like housing and education, healthcare, transportation, global trade. How does the way that we think about economics change the way that we seek to address the challenges that we face? How does our conventional model work now?
I'm really heartened, actually, to hear you say that people are talking about the economy as one of the root causes, because I think so often we confine ourselves to looking at the symptoms of an inhumane, unsustainable economic system and putting our shoulder into, I've trained myself over the last almost two decades living in the UK to say sticking plasters, but now I'm home, I can say band-aids now. So to, you know, put band-aids on that fallout, that collateral damage, and sort of that end of pipeline downstream, almost, you know, help people and planet survive and cope in the face of that inhumane economic system. And I think what we don't do is what I describe as channel our inner three-year-old enough and ask, but why, but why, but why? We don't look upstream sufficiently to understand that the root cause of so many of the challenges facing the world today is how we've designed our economy, who's winning and who's losing out of it, what sort of business models dominate, so that economic ecosystem, what sort of businesses and enterprises are set up, how we design our cities, what sort of energy systems we have, the tax system, what we subsidize, you know, what sort of rewards we're giving to certain economic behaviors, also production and consumption, how do we have this linear model of production where we take and, you know, use and throw it away, or we really understanding how we need to create a circular economy? And of course, at the heart of that is, do we see the economy as a goal in its own right? Do we see the economy as something to just grow bigger and bigger, and so often that's measured by gross domestic product? Or do we really understand what ecological economists, what feminist economists have been telling us for decades, and of course what First Nations communities have been living for millennia, this reality that the economy is a subset of society and the two are a subset of nature? And that's relatively easy to say. It's really a very profound mindset shift. And I think this idea that we ask more of the economy, we see the economy as in service of those higher order goals of delivering what people on planet really need, rather than us being on hand to just serve those economic goals, is the change in attitude, the change in approach, and then the change in systems that we need to set about building.
Tim, you would like to jump in?
Oh, I agree with, yes, so much of what Catherine's just been saying. It's fantastic to hear it presented in that beautiful way. Yeah, the point about the economy being kind of something that we're all in service to and literally often required to sacrifice to. It's like, you know, we are offering human sacrifices to the god of the economy. So often we're not allowed to tackle the climate crisis because what will happen with the economy? We're not allowed to, you know, lift welfare so that people can survive, because what will happen to the economy when the economy is us. The economy is our interactions, the way we exchange goods and services, the way we create, the way we replace, the way we exercise our humanity together as part of the natural world. The kind of the core of my book on living democracy is about the fact that democracy has to be participatory. It has to be the living extension of all of us. And the same goes for the economy. But the economic system that we're living in, like our democratic system in many ways, is very exclusionary. It divides us and conquers us. And it's a fundamentally extractive model. That's a different way of putting Catherine's point about linear versus circular. Our economy is fundamentally extracting resources from one place, putting them elsewhere, and as part of that, it's fundamentally about ownership and control and coercion. But that's not how humans generally actually like to interact, really. And that's the exciting thing for me, is that so much of the time when you're actually getting out into the community and seeing how people behave with each other, there's sharing going on. There's gifting going on. People, growing their own food and taking home cooked meals down to people who, live down the road, who might be friends or they might be in need. People helping each other with getting access to stuff that they might need, repairing goods, all sorts of things like that is actually going on in the economy already. But we don't count it as the economy. Yeah. And it's a re-envisioning that's already happening. And the question is, can we actually replace?
Catherine, I feel like we should just flesh out the issue around GDP and how our neoliberal economic system works at the moment before we work out what alternative models might replace it. Marilyn Waring on the podcast a couple of years ago, and just the first 15 minutes of that podcast, listening to her define and explain the history of GDP as a metric was an extraordinary privilege. I still go back and listen to it. Can you describe how our economic system works now and perhaps I think you've already explained a number of the ways in which it's not working for us in terms of contending with the challenges that are faced, but what are the parts particularly that you think need to be challenged?
So essentially, to me, I crude way, I describe the current setup as what I describe as sort of the long road story. So essentially the first step of that is grow the economy big, and so often that comes with turning a blind eye to the collateral damage that does to people and planet. The next step is to sequester as best we can some tax out of that with all the political machinations and, the Paradise Papers, all the tax evasion and avoidance that goes with that. So that's problematic. And then step three is use those funds to help people and planet cope with step one. And so essentially this is a highly inefficient, resource intensive, highly damaging way of doing things. And then the economic fundamentals that are used, these sort of mainstream economic measures that we assume there's a read across from growing the economy, there's this more productivity that'll automatically increase living standards. No one ever talks about what's the mechanism underneath that link. They just focus on how do we have more productivity. And there's a similar assumption that if we just grow the economy big, that'll automatically translate to better lives for people. And yet we've got decades of evidence that we can't rely on that process playing out. It so often growth of the economy has been channeled to those at the very top. And we can't just keep sort of growing the pie and seeing that as a solution, because scientists, and we're seeing the reality of this, that the oven is only so big. So if we're taking the reality of planetary boundaries seriously, we need to start to look for different solutions. And that agenda also doesn't recognize the reality of diminishing marginal returns. So this is a concept that's familiar in economics. But I was explaining it to my brother recently. It's essentially that if you say go to the markets and you try a little bit of cheese, the first bite of cheese is fantastic. Second bite's good too. Third bite's probably brilliant. By the time you're on your 18th or 19th or 20th, you've hit diminishing marginal returns. You're essentially getting less benefit for more incremental additions. And so it is with individual finances, and so it is at the macroeconomy. We know that at early stages of economic development, more growth, and with these key caveats that it's used well and invested into collective institutions, does yield returns in terms of social progress. But those benefits start to tail off. And whether you're looking at increases in life expectancy, literacy, falls in child mortality, all sorts of, and there's all sorts of measures that I can put for your show notes, things like the Social Progress Index or the Genuine Progress Index and a whole lot of other indicators show this, that you get less bang for your buck in the macro economy, the more growth you have. But perhaps even worse than that, what we're seeing is something I mentioned earlier, that so much of that money is now being justified on the grounds that we need it ultimately to repair the damage that's being done. And so within this, there's this idea that comes from management literature, but it's been applied to social policy in Scotland at least, and I hope we can start having this conversation in Australia around the extent of failure demand, just how much government resource, and you know, if we're honest, a lot of charitable effort goes with help to help individuals and communities cope with a system that doesn't keep people healthy enough, that doesn't help them feel safe, that doesn't help them feel connected, where they're feeling lonely and anxious, where they don't feel they have a purpose in life. And that shows up with a dollar sign in front of it, whether it's more mental health treatment units, whether it's more prescription drugs, anti-obesity treatments, whether it's more housing benefit because of our dysfunctional housing market, whether it's more security guards because we're scared of each other. And of course, in environmental terms, people talk about defensive expenditure. And the Insurance Council of Australia has just come out with a report a week or so ago, just putting down in paper the extent to which we spend so much money having to repair after floods, after bushfires. And it's just, it's in, on its own terms even, this is an insane way to run things. And we're reaching for these wrong recipes. We're measuring it with these metrics that come out of a completely different era, where that are made essentially to measure how monetized a society is. So the more that you pay someone to do something rather than rely on your community or the sort of examples that Tim was giving, GDP will go up. But it's consumption orientated. It's blind to distribution, so it doesn't track who's getting that wealth. So the tyranny of averages can offset, you know, profoundly unequal distribution. So we've got sort of outdated compasses, old recipes, and it really does put us back where you started this conversation, Anna Greta, in terms of, are we going to sort of open up our imaginations to believe that we can create a different journey for humanity with the economy in service of, you know, the economy being designed in a way to make that journey possible?
Catherine, you've just explained the reasons why we've been going through a multitude of systems under strain, and your beautiful analogy at the beginning that these, that we're treating symptoms, not the underlying cause. That was absolutely superb. But Tim, I wonder how the politics plays into this. Our political system, is it helping or hindering in how we might address these structural changes that might prevent the symptoms in the first place? How are we going with our political change?
I think we've got exactly the same process going on with our political system at the same time. Yeah, one of the things that was occurring to me as Catherine was speaking, in terms of the way the economy kind of drives ill health and mental ill health and all of these deep problems, is, you know, such a clear demonstration of the fact that this system is in crisis, and people can feel it is in crisis. It's no longer meeting that mythological promise that was so key to it kind of imposing itself on us through the 50s, 60s and 70s, that you know, the rising tide will lift all boats, that we'll all keep getting more prosperous. It's absolutely failing on its own terms, as you say, and seems pretty clear to me that the political system is doing exactly the same. We've had over the last couple of decades an absolute crashing in confidence in our democratic institutions, in Australia, in Europe, in America, all around the world. It's crashed from, you know, supreme confidence, like 80% of people saying, yes, these systems actually are working, down to 40% or lower. And it's really clear to people that, you know, our democratic systems and our economic systems are fundamentally intertwined, is the other really crucial thing, that people are seeing clearly that the reason our democracy is not actually living up to its promise, rule by the people, is because our political leaders are working hand in glove with those with the power on their hands on the economic levers. And there's some extraordinary analysis by Martin Gillens and co. In the US and others all around the world showing how political decisions bear virtually no resemblance to the will of the people, but bear a striking resemblance to the will of the donors and the wealthy and the people who are actually able to buy access and influence. And it's really obvious to people that that's what's going on now. So, yeah, I think what we're seeing, what we've seen in the last federal election result, for instance, is the latest step in a crashing in confidence in the two major parties, which has been tailing down for a couple of decades now and suddenly reached this point where a bunch of grassroots campaigns were able to actually take advantage of that and deliver the biggest crossbench we've ever seen. And so many of these other things happening around the place where, yeah, confidence in the systems, political and economic, is crashing and people are finding there's an opportunity there to do something new.
So we're at a moment in time, and these two elements of economics and how our politics work, particularly how our democracy is central to change, are such important threads that weave through all of the challenges that we face. We're going to take a really short break there, and we will be back in just a moment.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Listeners, welcome back. I'm here with Catherine Trebek and Tim Hollow. We're talking about the moment in time, a moment in time for policy transition, for social transition, for democratic transition, and for economic change. And before the break, we mapped out the reasons for dysfunction across a number of the challenges that we face, particularly social and environmental. And Tim, just before the break, we began to touch on some of the glimmers of hope, perhaps some of the small green shoots that are beginning to emerge from what has been a very destructive period in politics. The recent election, as you mentioned, did see a record number of smaller parties and community-minded independents brought into our federal parliament. Do you think these are the green shoots of hope? Do you see change for policymaking in Australia?
I think they're signs that people are starting to make their own hope. Put it that way. Hope's a funny word, isn't it? It can be in some ways quite a problematic idea when we say, you know, in the face of the climate crisis, oh, don't worry, it'll all be okay actually because humans are pretty clever. We'll work something out. That's not the kind of hope that I think any of us want or need. And same with politics. I don't want to point to the most recent federal election and say, this is reason for hope. I want to point to it and say, this is people actively making their own hope. And that, to me, is the exciting, hopeful stuff about the future. So, yeah, what we've seen, as I said, is with the crashing in confidence of both of the two major parties in the political system as it exists, the adversarial political system, this, you know, two parties that mostly agree on things but are fighting tooth and nail all the time. People getting fed up with that and starting their own process, whether it be kitchen table conversations or mutual aid programs or however it starts, starting to come together and creating a different political momentum and a different political system through that, whereby the representatives who are getting elected are answerable not to to donors and to, you know, and to back rooms, but to the grassroots communities that came together to elect them, whether they're independents or Greens or other minor and micro parties. And that presents an extraordinary opportunity what I suspect we're going to see from this parliament actually is the refusal of the mainstream political system to actually properly engage with that still, and another demonstration of failure, which will continue this process of transformation over the next little while. There's not a lot of signal, I think, that our press gallery, our major parties, our business community are really grappling with this shift yet, and there's a lot more to come.
Mm. Catherine, I wonder, particularly given that you've just returned from the United Kingdom, do you have any thoughts on the political changes that you've seen in Australia since you've been away?
So it is great to see at least a conversation where the reality of climate change, of course, so many Australians have been living and feeling for so long, is now being translated into some, the beginning, tentative and not nearly adequate enough steps forward. But I think also this idea of hope is something that we, it's really, really important to hold on to. And it is hard to feel hopeful given the enormity of change and the urgency of crisis. But where I guess I find hope is from what I describe as pioneers who are proving the possible, who are going against the headwinds of current systems, and despite all of that, are rolling up their sleeves and delivering, perhaps in microcosm, the sort of change we need to see. And Tim's pointed it out at the sort of local community level, and I think, you know, community gardens are a really cracking example of, you're prefiguring different modes of provisioning, different ways of spending time that's not all about consumption, different modes of looking after each other where people are welcomed on the basis of just being fellow humans rather than what they can afford to import. But also I see loads and loads of incredible businesses and enterprises who are using the sort of commercial viability not to make lots and lots and lots of profit in an extractive way, but to deliver what communities need or to deliver environmental solutions. And I think that's a conversation that probably the rest of the world hasn't sort of appreciated in Australia. I think there's incredible businesses here that are absolutely part of the solutions. And also I've been really fortunate to work with people at the heart of government who really recognize that in the 21st century, we need to have a different conversation about this idea of development as some sort of perpetual, infinite linear process, and who are rolling up their sleeves and trying to put collective well-being at the heart of economic policy. And Anna Greta, you mentioned sort of geopolitics at the beginning of our conversation. One of the most hopeful signs there is a tiny little initiative that I was part of instigating a few years ago called the Wellbeing Economy Governments Partnership. And that's led by Scotland with New Zealand and Iceland. And then during the last few years, Wales, Finland and Canada joined. And so these are diverse countries who are wanting to share and learn from each other what they're doing to broaden their ideas of progress, to support the sort of business models that we need more of in an economy that's aligned with what people and planet need, to really redesign the way government operates, move away from this sort of this silo approach where we pretend that what happens in the education department doesn't impact the health outcomes, that where we pretend what happens in your employment is irrelevant to the environment, where we actually look across that whole picture and look for co and multiple benefits. And so there's tentative examples, and often though think it's a little bit like my sort of nephew's bedroom, where there's lots of pieces of jigsaw or lots of pieces of Lego on the floor, but they're not yet joined up into something. And when I talk about the sort of change we need to build a wellbeing economy, to your really go of that profound realignment of our economic system so it's in service of what we really need, that idea of the jigsaw puzzle I think is quite important, because there are 1,000 pieces of changes we're going to need, whether it's in our tax systems, city design, you know, production, consumption, you know, what sort of business models do we want to bring to the fore, all those sorts of things, and so on and so on. And I sort of cluster them, you know, like you're doing a jigsaw puzzle, you start with the corners, don't you? And so often they describe these as the four P's of a wellbeing economy. So the first of those is purpose. You're really taking the lens of that 20th century measure of GDP off and all the perverse incentives that come with that, and putting collective well-being for, you know, people and planet at the heart of our government systems, at the top of the entry of government measures of progress, the political accountability. This is things like outcomes budgeting. There's talk of a well-being budget coming in. We'll see how that goes in the coming months. I'm excited to see that conversation. The next one is around prevention, and that's how do we look more upstream, going beyond those just sticking plaster band-aid solutions and servicing the failure? How do we take the time to understand the root causes and pay attention there? Not to denigrate the survival and coping, that's absolutely important. It's a humanitarian response, but we can't just stay there. We need to also look upstream. The third of these four P's of the jigsaw puzzle is a bit of a clunky term, but to me a really exciting concept, and that's pre-distribution. So how can we say it's not good enough just to let the gap between rich and poor open up in the first place and then try to slightly reduce it through taxes and welfare? How can we actually design the economy in a way that it generates more equal outcomes in the first place? And there's lots of pieces that you'd have in this corner of your jigsaw. It's worker cooperatives, it's true cost accounting, it's things like community wealth building, it's maybe living wages, maybe even we want to have a conversation about maximum wages, at least wage ratios, those sorts of things. And then the final P is people powered. And this really speaks to what Tim's book is about and his whole life work is about, is really putting people at the heart of those decisions, decision making, whether that's through more participatory democracy, citizens' assemblies, participatory budgeting, but also in the economy. So things like economic democracy, so that people are not feeling at the beck and call of wider economic flows, but they're actually able to have agency in economic decisions that matter to them at the firm level or at the wider economy level.
Mm, that's a really powerful model. Tim, I'm wondering how we incorporate the environment into the conversations around wellbeing. How does the environment sit with our politics, and how do we bring environment into this central conversation around wellbeing as an economic frame?
I think in all sorts of ways. You know, there's so much evidence now being built up from scientific research as if it were needed, because we all know it, that, you know, our own well-being is so guided by our contact with the natural world. And, you know, just finding yourself in nature, you know, admiring trees and birds and, you know, that gives us a tremendous amount of well-being in our daily lives. You know, we know now, for instance, that physically getting your hands dirty in the dirt, planting trees or you know, planting food and growing food in your own backyard is extraordinarily good for your physical and mental health. There are so many ways in which it interacts. You know, that's before you even get to the reasonably obvious stuff about clean air and clean water, which are obviously the fundamental underpinnings. So, yeah, I think it's crucial that we do draw into this whole picture the understanding that the economy and democracy and society are, you know, part of the natural world. Everything that we do as humans is fundamentally part of the natural world and inextricably intertwined with every other part of the natural world. We can't continue to consider ourselves and our economy and our politics as somehow separate. They're entirely reliant on a healthy biosphere. If we don't have a healthy biosphere, we cannot possibly have a healthy economy, a healthy community. And I think, you know, Catherine started early on talking about, you know, channeling our inner three-year-old and saying, why? This is stuff which is obvious to your average three-year-old. It's so damn obvious. And somehow, as we get older in our current system, as we grow up, and you know, I don't know, I've lost track of the number of times a right-wing person has told me to grow up and just deal with the world as it is, we're told to stop actually thinking in those terms and frankly indulge in this bizarre imaginary system whereby we are separate from nature and can continue to have a healthy economy and society without a healthy natural world. It's totally imaginary. And the reality, yeah, is dawning on a lot of people, I think.
Tim, that's really interesting, because the subtitle of a book I wrote a couple of years ago was Ideas for a Grown-Up Economy. So I don't know, maybe they were pointing you to read my book. But the first title was The Economics of Arrival. And essentially the sort of the essence of it is that maybe for countries like ours, or the country I've just moved from, the UK, that these countries have got enough. And what they need to do is allow themselves to say, hey, we've arrived. We need a different project now. And it's not more. It's learning to cherish the resources we've got and learning to share the wealth that we've got. And that's quite a different project. from one that's guided by this sense of scarcity and not having enough. And it's a conversation around how, you know, making ourselves at home once we recognize that we've arrived. And that's something I'm feeling really profound, having just come home to Australia and seeing everything anew, but also seeing how incredibly familiar it is, that just that contentment of that sense of home and that sense of place, that I think, you know, there's something really powerful about making sure that our economy is in sort of really aligned with that security. I mean, in a house, people, you know, are usually taken care of because of their needs, not because of, you know, what they bring in terms of financial resources. You know, people are not judged by what they're wearing. You know, first thing you do is when you come in from a day's work is, you know, take off your uncomfortable shoes and wipe off your makeup. There's where you can be yourself. And so the idea of, you know, making yourself at home, you know, ideas for grown-up economies is really about that. And I think one of the most dangerous images of the last few decades is that sort of early 1990s sustainable development goal image, where you had the economy, society, environment as three different pillars seen as equally important and similar to each other in terms of objective. And I think one of the essence of the wellbeing economy agenda is just to put the economy back in its place, as in service of society, individuals, communities, humanity, and equally in service of the planet in its own right too, not just for those beautiful wellbeing outcomes that you describe, but also, you know, because nature matters in and of itself. And that's also enough reason to take care of it.
So, Catherine, wellbeing metrics are now introduced, as you mentioned, across a number of countries, and there's a spectrum, I think, of engagement in terms of the economics of wellbeing and wellbeing economic frameworks. I'm wondering, you mentioned that in Australia, the new federal government has committed to putting wellbeing at the centre of the upcoming federal budget, and there's certainly more conversation around it than there's ever been before. I know the Centre for Policy Development recently released a report, Redefining Progress, which really looks at Australia's response to wellbeing economics, particularly in that global context. How are we doing with our wellbeing and economics compared to global peers?
So, I mean, what is exciting is that this isn't new territory. You know, Australia certainly won't be on its own in this journey. In fact, over half of the OECD countries have multidimensional wellbeing frameworks. They count a much wider range of what's important to people on planet and their citizens than simply the sort of fairly narrow basket of economic measures on their own, and they contextualize the role of the economy. Does that mean that over half the OECD countries are well on their way to building a wellbeing economy? Absolutely not, because I think this is a conversation we want to pay attention to in Australia, as the government does take these really important steps in exploring how to put wellbeing into budgets, how to put wellbeing into policymaking, and to the way government is done, is that we can't just broaden the basket and the dashboard of what we count and think job done. Fantastic. It has to be about asking those more fundamental questions about the nature of the economy and going through that mindset shift that we talked about to see the economy in service of those higher order goals rather than the other way around. So it's an absolutely vital, necessary but not sufficient step towards that journey. I've been really heartened by the conversations I've been having with folks here in Canberra, in the Treasury, in terms of their approach, in terms of them recognize that they won't be able to do everything in this first budget, that this will be the start of a conversation and the start of a process. And the good news is for Australia that, as I said, it's not alone. There's lots of other countries that want to go on that journey with them, support them. I'd love to see Australia in future be part of the wellbeing economy governments, not least as if we can get seven governments as part of WeGo. We can then call it the We7 to challenge the G7, and that might just bring about the sort of shift of geopolitics that we need.
I love that idea, absolutely. You've both explained in wonderful detail today that how changes to our political process and to our economic system help us to contend with the challenges that we face now and really move to the next era. I love that idea of the economics of arrival, Catherine. That's going to stay with me for a while. So as we're drawing this conversation to a close, I'd love to hear both of you comment on the interdependent relationship between economics and politics. Can we change one without the other? Do we need both to work in concert?
I'm happy to start, Tim. I mean, yeah, absolutely not. And I sort of refer to myself often as a political economist, and I use that term because folks who look at the economy without looking at power are going to be just stuck. And folks who look at politics without looking at the economy are also not going to see the full picture. And I think we need to understand how that the economy is about the rules of the game. And so often people say, well, the economy is broken. I never use that phrase, because I don't think the economy is broken. I think it's absolutely not serving enough people, but it is doing it exactly what it is designed to do. And so this has to be a political conversation in the broadest sense of the term politics. And I think it was Aristotle who said that, you know, politics is the art of living together. And so if we're going to have an economy that enables us to live together healthily and with the natural world in the coming years, we have to look at politics. It's not the be-all and end-all. And I think, as I said earlier, there's a lot of businesses on, you know, of their own will doing a lot of things almost also against some of the incentive systems that come out of politics. But I think if we're really thinking about redesigning our economy, the way we do politics and what the messages and the policy regime that shapes the economy is absolutely fundamental terrain.
Yeah, completely agree. You know, both the economy and politics are fundamentally about power and how power is currently exercised and how we can shift that. And in my opinion, what it's crucially about is how we can actually dissolve the various modes of coercive power that we have in both our economy and politics intertwined as they currently stand, and start to actually create the new, grow the new from the grassroots up, a whole different mode of cooperation and power. And that, I think, is an exciting model for what's already happening, because so many of the new alternatives are actually about democratizing the way we live and democratizing the way we do the economy. And so they're the same solutions, actually. You know, they're actually bringing in a new way of doing politics and a new way of doing the economy through the same living practices that we can actually bring into being. And as we do that, we can start to actually, you know, withdraw our consent from the really problematic modes that are creating the crises that we find ourselves in. And that's going to be the crucial piece of the puzzle, I think, as well, that, you know, as we build a well-being economy, we actually also have to dismantle the problematic economy, the extractive and destructive economy, in the same way that as we're building a participatory democracy, we're going to have to dismantle the coercive governing system that's causing the problems.
So a time of change, a moment in time, a fork in the road, the opportunity to define our future. Let's finish with one last question, and I have to say I very much want to have the two of you back again in the near future. But what is the number one piece of advice you'd like to give to policymakers faced with the challenges of our time, particularly around putting well-being of ourselves, of each other, and of the planet at the heart of our decision-making? Who'd like to go first?
Oh, I'm happy to. So, I mean, one, I think if only it was easy, it's just one piece of advice. This is a complex, multifaceted change agenda, but we can't let that be overwhelming. And I think, to me, it is back to be bold enough to not be content just to patch up the current system, and to take the time to look upstream and ask that question, channeling our inner three-year-old, asking, but why, but why, but why, and think about what are the root causes of so many of the crises facing people and planet, and then think about how do we design the rules of the game in a different way to encourage action that prevents harm happening in the first place, with the economy helping us get it right first time around.
Love it. Agree with Catherine. If only there were one answer, if there were one thing that I had to say, it's get up from your desk and go and talk to people. To me, this is, you know, one of the fundamental issues that we have in so many parts of our governing systems, our democracies, our economies, is that those who are making decisions are really completely disconnected from what's actually going on the ground to an extraordinary degree. And if you actually sit down and have conversations with people out in the community, if you go to their doors and chat to them, if you go and, you know, have a meal or wander around a shopping center or a market and talk to people, you'll find so many ideas and so much, you know, direction for a different way of thinking and a different way of doing. Get up from your desk and talk to people.
That is superb advice to leave today's conversation. Thank you so much for your time, Catherine Trebek and Tim Hollow.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
So I feel better. Talking with Tim and Catherine today does give me hope. I was particularly struck by Catherine's framing that many of the policy challenges that we discuss are symptoms of much deeper structural dysfunction, and that there are ways in which we can unpack the current way that we live and the way that we care for each other, which will address not just one problem, but help us to contend with the range of challenges that we discuss. Her argument for a transition to wellbeing economics is a compelling one. It does remind me that economics is a tool for shaping social decision-making and is a tool into which we should have great influence through our democracy. The compelling part of the conversation today was both the two elements separately, democracy and how better representation changes our decision-making, and our economic decisions and the economic framework, and how changes to our prioritisation and changes to our economic structures might lead to better outcomes for all of us. These two threads exist in isolation, and yet they're highly codependent. And I think Catherine made a compelling argument for the economics of politics and for the politics of economics being so deeply intertwined. These two great thinkers today offer me an extraordinary framework for transformative change. And this conversation is one I know I will return to many times in the months and in the years ahead. A glimmer of hope, those green shoots for change, offering us hope during highly uncertain and challenging times. So we will leave a link to the publications that we've discussed in the show notes. We love hearing from our audience, so please reach out to us on Twitter at AEPPS Policy Forum or APPS Policy Forum. You can send us an email at podcast@policyforum.net, or you can join our Facebook group at Policy Forum Pod. I'm so much looking forward to continuing into our conversations of systems under strain. And so from me, Anna Greta Hunter, I look forward to seeing you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.